Okay, so let's see. So I'm trying to remember exactly where the first task got to.
You had finished assuming things. You're about to prove something important.
Oh, okay.
You proved good equals correct.
At the end of the first half.
Yeah.
Right, okay, good. So it's the second half.
Okay.
So I'll take 3 of those 4 minutes to think about what I want to say, and then 1 minute to summarize. So the second half of last lecture basically was proving the threshold theorem, which says that if there's some threshold error rate, and if you're below this threshold error rate, then you can do arbitrarily long quantum computations. And the way to do that is concatenation, which you presumably have encountered on the problem set. But the basic idea is, the argument is, you have this procedure of making a fault-tolerant circuit to a non-fault-tolerant circuit, right? And that improves your error rate. I guess I didn't quite get to that argument. I just proved that good is equal to correct. But the point is, you need 2 errors in an extended rectangle to make it bad. And probably in the second half, I spent a lot of time explaining why you could replace a bad rectangle with a faulty gate. But once you've done that, then probably having a bad rectangle is some constant times p squared. But the constant counts a number of different pairs of locations you could have that could be bad. Okay? And once you've done that, so going down a level. So you have this concatenation procedure where you take your non-fault-tolerant circuit, replace it by a fault-tolerant one, and then you have another big circuit, and you can place each of the physical gates in that by the same procedure, right? So that gives you a concatenated code, a concatenated fault-tolerant procedure. And each time you do that, the error rate goes effectively from p to c times p squared. Okay, so if you do that once, it's p squared. If you do it twice, it's p to the fourth. If you do it 3 times, it's p fourth squared, so p to the eighth. Right, and so the logical error rate goes like p to the 2 to the l. But it's actually p over p sub t to the 2 to the l, where p sub t basically is 1 over this constant. And so that's the threshold. If you're below that threshold error rate, the error rate drops very rapidly to the level. And if not, then it will increase after. So anyway, that's the upshot. But I encourage you to watch the recording.
They're very comfy in the morning with a cough.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Then maybe it's worth starting. So if you thought last lecture was all about the assumptions, then you're going to like this lecture because it's also all about the assumptions. So this time it's really all about the assumptions. And so what I'd like to do is go through those assumptions again and think in more detail about whether we need them or not and what we actually do need in place of them. So might as well just kind of start at the beginning and go through them one by one and see what there is to say about them. In some cases there's only a little bit to say, in some cases there's a lot to say. So what's the first assumption? First assumption, so let's start with the circuits, right? Assumptions we need for the circuits. The first one there was that we had available any set of universal gates that we wanted. The rationale behind this was because our fault-tolerant circuits may use a particular universal set of gates. The ones I showed you, for instance, used the Clipper group plus the pi over 8 rotation. And so we wanted to be able to plug those into our threshold result and say, well, the threshold is the threshold on these gates. So okay, so let's think about relaxing this. Well, so clearly, we need some universal set of gates. So actually, now that I say this, I realize that it's maybe a little ambiguous. So the way we normally prove the theorem, the threshold theorem, assumes we have kind of arbitrary, truly universal set of gates. Let's just get any kind of computation, any kind of unitary, or at least close to any kind of unitary. But there's also a possibility of having gates that get kind of some encoded level of universality. For instance, if you just have gates with real amplitudes, we know that that's enough in a model of perfect computation to an arbitrary quantum computation. But then you have to ask whether that's enough in the context of fault tolerance. And for that particular case, I guess, yes, it is. Universality in general, I guess there's no strong result about that. So let's assume that we need a set of gates that's, certainly we know that we need some set of gates that's capable of doing quantum computation, right? Clearly, since we want to do quantum computation, and the presence of errors is not going to help. But it's, I guess there's maybe some slight gap of whether it has to be truly universal in the sense of getting close to any unitary, or just computationally universal in the sense of being able to perform some equivalent version of any quantum computation. So there's going to be some gap there. But actually, that's not what I really want to talk about. So the real point to make here is the question, well, okay, what if we have some universal set of gates, but it's not this particular set, or it's not the particular set that we use to construct our fault tolerance circuits? What happens then?
Well, worst case, you could just simulate those ones with the set you've got.
Absolutely. Since it is a universal set of gates, we can always get, in particular, we can always get the perfect group gates and the Poivre gate out of it. And in fact, you don't need the whole perfect group gate record, you just need the generators of the perfect group, the control knot, the Hadamard, and the Poivre 4 rotation.
Or any other equivalent set of generators, right?
Yeah, or any equivalent set of generators. But the point is that those things just act on a constant number of qubits. And that's important because, well, it's important for a couple of reasons. But one of the reasons is that, well, no, it's, I guess this is the reason, the only reason, really, which is that when you try to construct these gates out of this other universal set, sorry, right, right, if not, that's ambiguous. So when you try to construct this set of gates out of some other universal set, then it might take a lot of gates to do that. And as long as you're working with only fixed-size gates, that's okay, because it's just some constant. But if it's lots and lots and lots of gates, I mean, so if you have to construct n-qubit gates directly out of this other universal set, then it's kind of ugly. But we don't have to do that, so it's not an issue, right? And in particular, when I defined this, I said it was any particular universal set of gates acting on a bounded number of qubits. So we still only have to act on that bounded number of qubits. So if we have some other universal set, we can construct the desired one. In the actual available case. Okay? So clearly we don't need to have this original assumption of having any universal set of gates. However, there's at least two things to be cautious of. Okay? Does anyone see one? Yes.
This makes your threshold worse.
Makes your threshold worse. So why does it make your threshold worse?
It takes a bunch of gates to simulate a gate.
That's right. And if any one of them goes wrong, the compound gate that you're making could be wrong. And how much worse does it make it? Well, we can set a bound on that, right? We know the number of gates that it takes to simulate these other gates. Okay, but this brings up the other problem, which is that when we're saying a universal set of gates, we're allowing, for instance, finite sets to be universal, right? Which means they don't exactly construct every gate, but they get very close to any other gate. And in fact, they get arbitrarily close. But to get arbitrarily close, you need an infinite number of gates, right? So what if you can't exactly construct these original gates? We don't want to have an infinite decrease in the threshold. That would not be too useful. So how do we deal with this?
We get close and then call the difference an error.
Sure. We're dealing with errors anyway, right? So if we don't have an exact approximation or an exact construction, we can allow an error in the construction. And correct it using regular fault-tolerant procedures. So of course, doing this is going to make the threshold worse again. Right? So we have another source of errors. Yeah?
So we did we ever consider gates, imperfections in the gates themselves, meaning inaccuracy in the amplitudes?
Well, depends what you mean. So certainly our constructions allow faulty gates, right, which would then be replaced by something else. But you're right in the sense that our model of those errors was that there was a probability, 1 minus p, that there was no error and the gate was perfect. And a probability p, the gate was imperfect. And what we're talking about here, well, it's a product of unitary gates. Right, so there's going to be some unitary thing that's not the right unitary thing, but is close to it. So that doesn't actually fit that model. Luckily, that's another one of the assumptions that we're going to go into, but it turns out that that's not, that we can get around, that we don't need that model. Yeah, but that's in the second set of assumptions that I haven't got to. Okay. Excellent one. Coherent errors. Great. Okay? So everyone see that one. So this last point brings up another issue. Well, so once we do the fault tolerant structure, then at the other end we have logical gates. And those logical gates are also drawn from some particular universal set, which I guess in general doesn't have to be the same as the ones we started there, but usually will be. Okay. So at the end, we have logical gates that are pi over 8 gate in the periphery group. But now we want to use some algorithm, right? And that algorithm might use a different set of gates, right? Like Shor's algorithm uses gates with rotations pi over 2 to the k. Right? So how do you get those? Well, the same thing. We can put products of these things together to get good approximations. But there's an issue there, right? Because now we can't do what we just said. If we don't have an exact construction of those gates, then there's some error left over. And now we can't do fault tolerance again to get rid of it, right? Because that would be circular. Okay, so there's something to worry about here. fault-tolerantly. That makes sense, right? Okay. And so again, we need to approximate, or in some cases, we may need to approximate. We may be able to get some exactly. And what accuracy of approximation do we need? Well, we encountered this before at the end of last lecture. If we have a calculation of size t, we want the logical error rate to be roughly 1 over t, right? So that we have some constant probability of getting through. We could make it better than that if we wanted, but at least once we have a constant probability, we can then do it a couple of times, maybe get a majority vote, something like that. So we need accuracy about 1 over t for a computation of size t. Okay, so how many of these logical gates are we going to need to do that? Well, luckily, it's not that many. So there's a theorem due to Bob Solovey and Alexey Kitaev, which says the number we need is only like log of the accuracy we want, or polynomial and log of the accuracy. Here's a version of it. Okay, so basically what we want to do is we want to take the particular universal set of gates we have coming out of fault tolerance. And it turns out this theorem doesn't depend so much on exactly which set of gates you have. You should have some universal set of gates. And you want to use them to construct the gates that appear in the algorithm. So actually, we really like to use them to construct the whole algorithm, of course. But constructing an arbitrary unitary, that could take lots and lots of bits, right? I mean, past it, because it's on n qubits, and there's some unitaries that take lots and lots of bits to construct. So let's just say that we're going to fix ourselves to acting on a constant number of qubits. So for instance, the specific gates, you know, the pi over 2 to the k rotation, for instance, that appear for Schwarz algorithm, something like that. Okay? So then, how many gates does it take to do that? So it turns out that it's again a polylog factor. So that's a good thing, right? Because if the blow up from the Threckel theorem was a polylog factor, but the blow up from here was a polynomial factor, then the fact that it was only a polylog factor from the threshold would be kind of moot, right? Because we'd still be getting this polynomial blow up from the fact that we had to go through this other set of gates. Yeah?
And does it use any ancilla, or is it only on those approximations?
So I think this theorem is proven in the case. So actually, yeah, so I think this is proven for the case where the universal set of gates originally does not use any ancillas, and then the construction itself doesn't use any ancillas. Or at least doesn't use any quantum ancillas, in the sense that you do have to do some classical work to figure out kind of a set of things to draw from. And that's another important fact about this theorem, which is that, well, okay, how long does it take to find this product? Right? Because it took a really, really, really long time. It took an exponential amount of time, say. then it would be very useful. Luckily, that also doesn't take very long. So maybe that finding the optimal one, for all I know, that takes a very, very long time. Probably does. But at least you can find one approximation of this length and that accuracy. I think also in probably a lot of time. Yeah.
Then what is that?
Well, it's not so important that it's poly log, but it certainly has to be efficient, right? Because otherwise, you have this particular set of gates you want. You need very, very good accuracy, right? You need accuracy 1 over t, where t is the size of a computation, which could be, you know, a billion or something. So if the time it took to find the actual approximation that gave that good accuracy was exponential in epsilon, or even just polynomial in epsilon, would be kind of annoying, then you'd have a big blow up in the amount of time you had to work to find this good fault tolerance construction.
But that's all done offline.
Well, it's, yes, it's done offline. So you don't have to, that's right, so you don't have to keep your quantum computer coherent while you're doing this. But it's one thing to say that Schrodinger's algorithm takes, you know, time n cubed, where n is the number of bits in number. But if it took time n to the fifth just to find the appropriate set of gates, that might kind of color your description of how long Schrodinger's algorithm took. It doesn't, so it's not a point. But there is something there that is required. And if it took time 2 to the n, then you'd really be out of it, right?
Also makes sense for algorithms which have polynomial speed up.
Right.
To create the circuit that we saw.
Yeah, so actually that's a good point about fault tolerance in general. That for algorithms with a polynomial speed up, since the overhead is only poly log, you know, square root speed up for Grover's algorithm, for instance, is still useful. You don't lose it by going to fault tolerance.
So this is because we are also wanting the circuit to be produced. Basically, uniformity is also what is required. The circuit to be produced in polynomial time by a Turing machine.
Well, yeah, okay, that's basically what this is saying. I mean, it's better than that because it's actually not polynomial; it's poly log. But yes, basically, if it weren't uniform, that would be a problem.
Yeah, but I mean, that's only when we want.
Yes, but we do want uniformity.
Yeah, but it's not like connected with issues of polynomials.
No, so it's connected in this sense that if it weren't true, that fault tolerance as a practical thing would be less useful than fault tolerance as a theoretical idea. But it is true, so fault tolerance. I mean, this is another barrier that could be presented against practical fault tolerance, right? Against it being as useful in the real world as we'd like it to be.
Well, an argument would be I only have to find it once, so you have to fix that.
Well, yes. So if you're doing kind of Schrodinger's algorithm over and over and over again, then maybe it's not such a big deal. And a number is always the same size, you know, because everyone uses keys of the same size. Then yeah, that's right. So it's a one-time thing. But again, if it's exponential, then you still wouldn't be able to do it even once. Okay? I agree. It's not quite so important that it's poly log. But it is important, I think, that it's efficient. Okay. So everyone happy with that one now? Okay. Then let's move on. So what's the next assumption? Okay, so in the In the old thing, we assumed that we could take any pair of qubits or a triplet of qubits, we had 3-qubit gates, and do a gate between them, right? No matter where they were physically located in the computer. Basically, there was no geometry. Okay? So this is maybe vaguely plausible for some kinds of models of computation, like LOQC, linear optics quantum computation. Photons move around pretty easily, so it's not so hard to imagine interacting them wherever they are. I mean, you get some big, well, okay, so the optical table gets really, really cluttered with optical elements to move all this stuff around, but you can at least imagine it being possible, right? These optical fibers, you can go all around each other and past each other. But there's lots of other systems in which that's not at all possible. That qubits that are far away are going to have a much higher error rate than qubits that are close together. Or maybe you can't directly do gates between qubits that are far away at all. You can only do nearest neighbor gates. Okay? So in that case, well, first of all, can we still do quantum computation? And the answer is yes, as I hope you all know, right? Because if you have two gates that are far away, you can, well, take this qubit and move it all over here and do a gate over here and then move it back. Or there's, you know, better things. You can set up an EPR pair, do teleportation, and if necessary, teleport it back.
Yes. That's going to mess up one of those things, right? Because now simulating a constant, a gate or a constant number of qubits no longer needs, I mean, could need a linear number of gates to simulate it.
Well, right. So if your fault tolerance, so this was the next question. Was, what does this do to fault tolerance? Right? If you have qubits that are very far away, and you need to gate between them, well, then it takes, if they're distance n away, then you have to do n steps to bring them together, or n steps to create this EPR pair. And if each one of those steps has an error rate, say a constant probability p of error, then once n gets to be around 1 over p, well, the error rate is going to be too high, well above the threshold. Okay? So what do we do about that? Well, so the solution is that, well, we don't have to put qubits far apart unless they're at high levels. Okay, so let's think about that a little bit. So this one is not going to be necessary. And the way we do that is concatenate locally.
Daniel,
yes.
I mean, we can think of it like this, right? That the original logical circuit, right, if it involved 2-qubit gates of far apart qubits, would just be replaced by another circuit by linear blowout.
Sure.
Which does not have that.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
then
fine.
Then you have still, I mean, then you can just do a fault tolerant on that.
No, that's not right. I mean, it is right, but it's not, you need to make a better argument. Okay, because the problem is the fault tolerance itself involves adding lots of extra qubits. And the question is, where do you put all those qubits, right? So if you have n levels, or I should use a different number, different letter. So if you have L levels of concatenation, then say you've added 7 to the L qubits for each logical qubit. Actually more than that, right, because there's a bunch of n syllables. And so if you had to do gates between, and you do, in fact, have to do gates between 2 qubits that are very far apart in that 7 to the L block. Right? So how do you do that, right? Because that would be an overhead of 7 to the L. And the answer is you do have to do that, but you don't have to do it very often.
No, but what we are saying at the beginning is that our circuit itself doesn't have such gates. I mean, our logical circuit.
Yes, our logical circuit doesn't have such gates. The question is, does the fault tolerant protocol have?
So basically, when we're constructing a logical gate using our physical gates, does that construction have?
That's right. Right? Okay. And so the way we avoid having to do this, like I said, very often, that these long-range gates, is by doing our concatenation locally. So what happens is, so one level of concatenation requires some constant blowout. Okay? And so, for instance, for working in two dimensions, we replace one qubit by a bunch of qubits like this. And they're all within some constant range. Yeah.
Then, but when we're constructing the logical gate using physical gates, then everything is constant, right? There's no end there.
No, I mean, so when you have
that circuit, it does that.
No. So when you have this is the current argument is saying that each level of concatenation involves a constant size blowup, but the whole circuit involves a blowup exponential size the number of levels, right? Which is admittedly polylog in the total size of the computation, but it's unbounded in the size of the computation.
But whenever we are constructing just one level, right, going from one level to the other, right?
Yeah.
We are constructing one logical gate with a set of physical gates. In that construction, if you make sure that we don't have far apart.
Well, that's right. That's right. This is just what I'm saying now. So let me say it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so each level of concatenation requires a constant size blowup. Okay? And we can write this circuit. Using only nearest neighbor gates. For instance, by using swap gates, we get a qubits that need to interact. Okay. And so doing this, again, for one level of concatenation, that's okay. So it involves some constant blow-up, and so that's going to hurt the threshold, of course, because we have to add these extra swap gates. But there still should be a threshold. Right? Okay, but there's a problem with this, which I'll get to in a minute. Let me just finish this argument first. So we do this, and then we have just a circuit of nearest neighbor gates, and we can concatenate again. So the point is that you do this once the error rate gets lower. You go from a circuit, logical circuit with nearest neighbor gates, to a physical circuit with nearest neighbor gates. And then you can do it again, right? And by the same argument as before. Okay? And so in particular, what's happening is that at level J, qubits need to interact at a distance which is exponentially k. So some constant to the k. I think I used big N before. Anyone remember? Well, this might depend on the dimension, right? If in three dimensions, you can make a cube root of n, for instance. So qubits need to interact at a distance about n to the j, but the logical error rate is given by that formula from before, right? So it's p over p sub t to the 2 to the j. right? So even though the distance is exponential, the error rate is now double exponential. So this kind of negligible. Okay? And in particular, we don't need to do it very frequently because we're constantly doing lower level error correction. So what's going to actually what's actually going to look like if you were to look at the circuit here is you'd say, well, okay, we have a qubit or a logical block over here that needs to interact with a logical block over here. But the distance is really, really long in physical distance. So we move it over partway, we do error correction at the lower level. We move it over partway again, we do another lower level error correction, and so on. Right? And actually, if this is multiple levels of concatenation, it's this each of those lower level moves also involves stopping doing error correction, stopping doing error correction, right? So you go a little distance, you do level one error correction. You go a little distance, you do level one error correction again. Then you do a little distance, you do level one error correction. Now you do level two error correction. And then you do this whole procedure again. And eventually you're going to do level three error correction and so on. Okay? So the whole thing gets self-similar and it's very cumbersome. But it does work. Okay?
What is capital L here again?
Well, it doesn't really matter. Basically, it's the distance. Here, we can say it's this distance.
It's basically the
distance that everything gets blown up by one level of concatenation. So that since we're starting with a logical circuit that only involves nearest neighbor gates, that distance one gets blown up to distance n. Okay, so I said there's a problem with this. Has anyone spotted it? Well, if I put that up here, that'll be two problems. Even three problems, so I don't have an eraser or a star. Okay, so anyone spotted the problem?
I don't know, it seems the farther you have to move, the less computation you can do.
Well, it's not that there's less computation you have to do, it's just that it takes longer. Right, but again, it's only a polylog look because we don't need very many levels. So that's not the problem. We had that anyway. I mean, this is worse, but.
Can I say something? So once we have made sure that going from one level to the other, there are no non-neighbor gates, right? Then why do we get at all non-neighbor gates?
Oh, so the point is that let me rephrase what we need to do, which is that the original fault tolerant gap list that I wrote for you involved non-neighbor gates.
Right.
So if you just do those replacements, you would get non-neighbor gates. Yeah, so all I'm saying is you have to rewrite them so that they involve only nearest neighbor gates.
Right.
And you can certainly do that. Well, no, not certainly do that. That's where the issue is. Once you've done that, clearly it only involves, if you can do that with just a constant blow up, then you're set.
Then there's nothing after that. I mean, then this at level j qubit need to interact with distance n to the j. That's not there.
No, that's not really part of the proof. That's just kind of an explanation of what's going on. By this I mean physical qubits. Physical qubits need to interact with distance n to the j.
After we have done that?
Yeah.
You have to suck in silly all the damn time to get fault tolerant, don't you?
Well, yeah. Okay, so actually that's a good point. We haven't quite gotten to the issue of fresh ancilla. So let's assume for the moment. So first of all, this block needs to include all the local ancillas that you need. That's clearly true, to do error correction. So remember one of the assumptions, some point, is that we have the ability to reset ancillas. So let's assume we can do that in place. Okay, and we'll discuss later on whether or not that's needed. Yeah?
How easy is it to make the circuit into a nearest neighbor?
Well, so it seems like it should be easy, right? Because I just told you how to do it, right? So if you have two gates, two qubits that are far apart, and you want them to interact, you just use swap gates to move them next to each other. then you gate, and then you swap gates to move them back. Right, so that seems like a pretty automatic procedure. So the catch is that as we've defined things, it's not a fault-tolerant procedure.
Right, because
it's like grass and then the block. Right. These are not transversal swap gates because, I mean, they might be in some cases, but it's hard to guarantee that. Okay? And so in particular, so first of all, there's two problems that are associated with non-transversal gates, right? So let's think about two of them. So the first one is error propagation. Luckily, that's not a problem, right? A swap gate can't propagate errors because it doesn't actually interact with two qubits, it just swaps them. But the other problem does apply. Right? Which is that if you have an error in one of these swap gates, both of the qubits involved in that swap gate could go bad. Right, which means that a single bad location, single bad swap gate location in particular, can cause two qubits within a block to be bad, have errors. Okay. And so if we're dealing with a code that only corrects one error, that's clearly a problem. Yeah? No?
Maybe. Can you always do this on the edges of the blocks, though? Swap the two that are touching? And then?
Probably yes. So, okay. So, so there's two classes of solutions that you can try to take here, okay? So, one class of solutions is to say, so if it's a code that corrects one error, maybe we're out of luck. But a code that corrects two errors should be able to deal with this. This is not an ideal solution because you're using a code that corrects two errors, which means it's bigger, but you're only letting there be one fault in the rectangle. Right? So you're not, even though it's bigger and corrects more errors, you're not really taking advantage of the fact that it corrects more errors. Except for the fact that you can do it at all. So I guess it's taking advantage. So anyway, I have you do some things about how to modify the fault tolerance conditions to be compatible with this in the problem set. But let me also mention the other possible solution, which is simply to try to design a circuit that doesn't have this problem. So I think Kolb's solution is correct in that I think there is a way to swap them so that they never interact with the same block. I don't think anyone's actually followed that up. There's a paper that uses the appropriate circuit, but I'm not sure they didn't appreciate this fact. And I'm not absolutely positive it's true, so you'd have to check it yourself. So that's fine. So if that works, that's okay. There's still a little complication in that circuit like that would still interact, say, qubits from the data block with qubits from the Ancilla block. And then a transversal gate, right, might cause the error, and they're different qubits, different locations in the block. So a transversal gate might still cause that error to propagate from the Ancilla to the data, for instance. So you still have to be kind of careful with that to see if it's really this circuit as a whole will satisfy your four-color procedure. So better things to do, one where they don't even interact qubits in the same block. They don't interact a computational qubit with an Ancilla qubit. So they don't interact any two qubits that you're using for anything important. Well, okay. So let me show you how you do that. So obviously, to do this, you're going to have to add dummy qubits. So for instance, we might have a design in two dimensions that looks like this, where we have computational qubits on the x's and then dummy qubits on the o's. Okay? And then to swap two things around without interacting any two computational qubits, we could do a series like this. So let's say we can do along diagonals. This could be simpler. We'll swap these two and these two. And let's call this x1 and x2, so we can keep track of where they are. Right, and that would give us and then we can swap these two and these two. And the x1 is down here and the x2 is up here. Okay? And you can see that when we did this, we never had to interact the data qubit, a qubit that's used in the computer. The qubit that does anything interesting. Okay? So this works great in two dimensions. If you have not a one dimensional thing, but one thing with two lines, then you can still do this. But if you have just one line of qubits, then you have to do something more strenuous. Okay?
And so what happens in that case that, say, one of those swaps went wrong?
Mm-hmm. So say this one goes wrong, right? So this data qubit, this computational qubit, is ruined. And also this dummy qubit is ruined. Mm-hmm. But who cares about the dummy qubit? It didn't have a right value anyway. And the only way it interacts with things is through swap gates. And swap gates don't propagate errors. So we don't have to worry about it somehow infecting some of the other qubits.
So in the end, only x1 would be wrong.
That's right.
X1 and x.
Yeah. And then we're back to the previous situation where a single faulty gate can only cause an error in a single qubit.
Does this necessarily need sort of 2D?
Well, so if you're really in 1D, then there's no way to move them past. So if you have next nearest neighbor gates, then you're okay again. But if you have nearest neighbor gates in one dimension, it's truly one dimension, mm-hmm. then eventually you're going to get a situation where you have two computational qubits that have to move past each other, and you just can't do that. You need some extra space. Like I said, two lines is enough. Next nearest neighbor gates is enough. Any other questions? No? Okay. So there's now been a bunch of work studying thresholds in these lower dimensional cases. So if you have, you gonna be able to see this? So in two dimensions, so these are going to be 2D results. So in two dimensions, there's a proof that the threshold is above, 1.1 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay, which is, I guess, not so much worse than the threshold you get for the concatenated 7-qubit code without in arbitrary dimensions. So they did a lot of work to make sure that you didn't have to move things very far. Yeah?
Optimized being the just...
Optimized for this 2D layout, basically. Yeah, so it's suboptimal if you try to do it in without geometry, because, well, there's various things it does to, that are good for this layout and bad for... It, or at least you can do better when you don't have to worry about space or about distance. Okay? And then there's another approach, which Robert may have mentioned in his lecture, I don't know. But so using kind of different ideas, so cluster states, which Robert probably mentioned, and topological codes, which we're going to talk about in a couple of weeks. Then they get about 6 times 10 to the minus 3. That's a simulation. Okay, yeah?
The threshold theorem for cluster state computing follows more or less the same game, despite the fact that it's...
So that's a good question. So there's some papers on fault tolerance with cluster state computing. There's one thing you kind of have to worry about, which turns out not to be a problem, but it's not so obvious right off the bat, which is in cluster state computing, you do all your gates that you do are kind of dependent on the measurements that came before. And so you'd have to worry that particularly for the non-Clifford group gates, that if you make an error in one of your previous measurements, then that will come back to haunt you when you try to figure out what to do the right thing for this non-Clifford group. Okay. So it turns out that's not actually a problem. But you have to do some analysis to really convince yourself of that. Mm-hmm.
Does this assume perfect nearest neighbor gates?
Sorry, what do you mean? So this is fault tolerance, so we're obviously not assuming.
Sorry, I guess I'm still. Something's just not sitting well. So in the case of an ion trap, you have fields where you interact two drives, and maybe straight fields, it would. Touch, maybe say the next to us.
So we're still assuming all the other stuff we had. So one of those assumptions was that, for instance, that errors only affect, so a gate error only affected the 2 qubits involved in the gate. And, you know, there were all the other assumptions as well about, you know, measurements and classical computation being free and things like that.
Can we eventually relax those?
Well, that's, yeah, that's what the rest of the lecture is. Yeah, so when we're done, we can maybe start to talk about if there's some combinations that work and some combinations that don't. But actually, I think most of these work. Well, anyway. You can pretty much take any combination. It's a question of what it's going to do to the threshold, which is not obviously been, not all possible combinations have been studied there. And so in 1D, there's been less study. 1D is harder. But there's a recent paper by Austin, who I know is currently in the APS meeting. And so they got a proof that in 1D, at least with these two lines of qubits, so maybe I should say that 1D with two lines, that they have 2 times 10 to the minus 6. Although I think it's with slightly different assumptions about the relative error rates of different things. But should be roughly on that order. Yeah?
With strict 1D, you get screwed in a hurry, then.
Well, with strict 1D, at least the most straightforward thing is to do this approach.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it gets much worse, because once you use a code that uses two errors, you have a lot of extra overhead. And so a lot more possible pairs of locations that can go wrong. So I don't know that anyone's actually worked that out. But you should ask Austin when he gets back, because he may have. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So then maybe we can move on. I mean, it seems like we're going really, really slowly. But those two were some of the longer ones to have. Next couple will go pretty fast. So assumption three was that we had fresh ancillas. And I guess we assume that we had them on the map. Okay, so what do people think? Is this one necessary or not? So this one is, in fact, necessary. So why is that? Well, so if you create all the ancillas at the beginning of the computation, and they're having errors too, right? Then if you wait a long time, and the computation could be very long, in fact, then those ancillas will have heated up. The total number of ancillas you need is only polynomial, so it's not the number of ancillas that's the problem. It's the fact that a lot of them have had to wait around for a long time. And then their error rates will be high, and they'll be above the threshold.
Can we do error threshold?
Well, but to do that, you need more ancillas. Okay? So actually, yeah, so in that case, so that is actually a possibility. But if you do that, then to do the error correction, you need more ancillas, and then to do the error correction on those ancillas, you need more ancillas. And what happens is the number of ancillas you need is exponential in the size of the computation you want to do. Yeah?
But isn't this how cluster state computing mostly works? Like, make everything at the beginning and go?
That's right. So cluster state computing in that model does not work polynomially. So I guess when I said that it goes straightforwardly, I guess that was a slight lie. So when people talk about qual-polynomial cluster state computing, what they're thinking of is a model where you kind of alternate, where you do one big block where you make a cluster state, and then you do measurements, and then you do another big block, and then you do measurements again. Okay, and you keep doing this. And so if you do it that way, then it's okay, because then every time you make this new block, you reset your ancillas. Okay, so that is important to fact. So the other thing to say about this is you can think of this as kind of a thermodynamic requirement. In the sense that error correction is always a kind of thermodynamic process, quantum error correction, right? Because the environment is interacting with the system. It's adding noise to it. It's increasing the entropy. So basically, it's heating it up. Okay? And then to cool it down again, to get rid of that entropy, you have to have some cold heat dump, heat sink, that you can pump that entropy into. And that's what the ancillas are for. Okay? But to do that, they have to be cold. If they've heated up to the same temperature as the bath, then you're not going to get any cooler than that. Yeah?
You don't have to be quite on demand, though, right? You can just say, I would like to have an ancilla sometime soon.
Sure. So I guess it's the same thing. Well, we'll see this kind of solution multiple times, which is, yeah, so if you don't quite perfectly have this, If you get an ancilla and then you have to wait, you know, five time steps, well, then the ancilla will just have these extra five time steps worth of errors, storage errors, while it's waiting around to be used.
So by on demand, do you more mean like as much as gonna, as long as I ask for an ancilla, I can get it?
So it's the main thing, I guess the main thing is that ancillas. must weigh at most a bounded amount of time before being used. Bounded time before being used. Okay, so that in particular, as the computation gets longer and longer, or larger and larger in some other dimension, the ancillas don't have to wait longer and longer. Right. Again, because this time that they have to wait gets added to their error rate. Right. And in reference to this this previous point, it's also important that they be located in the right place. Because if you have a big computation, you can only create ancillas on the end of it. Then by the time they get to where they're needed, they'll also heat it up too much. And again, of course, they don't have to be exactly where they're needed. They could be somewhere nearby if you move them. But again, with some extra effect. Yeah?
If you just have some finite constant set of ancilla, and you every time you measure them away, you can reinitialize them to zero.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so it's, I mean, we don't care. Once we've done with ancillas, we don't care what happens to them. We might as well reuse them.
Then, if you be creating all the ancillas beforehand,
The problem is if you create them at the beginning of the computation, then you know you do a computation of t time steps. Then the ones that you use for error correction at the end of the computation will have been waiting this t time, and they'll have t time steps worth of storage errors on them. So they'll have very high error rate, which will be above the threshold.
But the final circuit that we produced was of polysize, right? Including all the ancillas that we ever needed.
Yes, but the error rate per time step is constant, right? For this, that's what the threshold theorem says. So the probability of not having an error on an ancilla over time t is 1 minus p to the t, right? Which is exponential.
But we were also counting the identity locations, right?
Yes, that's the point. That's the problem.
Locations behind those polynomials.
Yeah, yeah. But if you have a polynomial sized circuit, the probability of having no errors in that circuit is exponential. Right? This is why we need error correction in the first place. Otherwise, we could just do the whole circuit and hope that there were no errors.
So this you're talking about not the logical circuit, but the gadget circuit.
Yeah, you guys look at what happened to this ancilla before you use it. And if it's weighted at time t, then the probability of not having an error on it is exponentially small in t. Other questions? Okay. So the next two I'm going to kind of lump together. The next two were, in some order, that you have measurements, you have the ability to do measurements during the computation, not just at the end of the computation, and that you had classical computation that was fast enough that you could kind of ignore how much time it took.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
So I guess when you design your circuit, you also want to think, just as you did for this, the long-range gates, you want to design circuits for software interact, blah, blah, blah. You probably also want to design circuits where it's still a you can create it still where you need them, right?
Well, so yeah, so that's not so much a question of designing circuits as designing your machine. It's a question
like
of what you want
to design. So you get them when you need
them. Yeah, I mean, so the point is if you have some location where you're resetting the ancillas, then you need to design your machine so that there's one of such locations near every lowest level block.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, from the point of view of the abstract thing I'm talking about, creating a new ancilla is not a location. It's just another type of location, in the sense of gates and storage areas and stuff like that. It's another type of thing that I have. I mean, it's also necessary. I mean, I guess I haven't been saying this, that you can do gates between, when you're doing this, you're doing gates between arbitrary nearest neighbors, right? So you could imagine an even more restricted geometry where there was only some nearest neighbor gates that you could do. But that's maybe getting beyond the scope of what we'd like to think about. I mean, obviously, if you're designing a physical machine, there's going to be limits to how many connections you want to put in it. And so you might try to minimize that. But the basic idea is that this argument holds regardless. But OK, so going back to this next thing. So we have measurements and classical computation. So why did we want this, remember? Well, we use them in two places. So one of them is when we do error correction. In the error correction circuits I showed you, I said, well, we'll interact with the ancilla, then we'll measure the ancilla. And then classically, we'll figure out what the error syndrome is and correct it. We'll use the classical control to correct it. And the other place we used it was when we had some of these other weird constructions, like the teleportation-based thing for the Potter 8 gate, where we said, well, we'll do this Bell measurement, then we'll measure, and then we'll do a Clifford group gate, depending on the outcome of the measurement. And it's kind of important that we actually were doing that measurement, right? Because while the Clifford group gates, you know how to do transversally, when you do that measurement, you're doing really a controlled Clifford group gate, right? Control based on the outcome of the measurement. A controlled Clifford group gate is not itself a Clifford group gate in general. Obviously, there's the special case where it's a controlled polling, which is a Clifford group gate. But other than that, it's not. Right, so So how are we going to get around this? Can we get around it? Maybe we really need these things. There is a solution, though. It's not necessary. And I think this was mentioned last time in discussion, which is that, well, OK, quantum circuits can do anything classical circuits can do, right? So what you can do is you can take all this classical processing and replace it with quantum circuits to do the same thing. Okay, but there's an issue here because, well, now that we've replaced these classical gates with quantum gates, they're not reliable anymore. Right? Before, we assumed the classical computation was reliable. So we have to make these quantum circuits fault-tolerant again. But that seems like another circuit argument, right? That in order to make quantum fault-tolerance, you need to replace a classical circuit with quantum circuits, which you have to make fault-tolerant, which you'd think would need another level of fault-tolerance, right? But it doesn't have to be, because these are really classical circuits, even though we're using quantum gates to do them. So we don't need quantum fault tolerance, we need classical fault tolerance.
We can still have coherent errors.
We can have coherent errors, but we don't care. Right? If there's a phase error in this classical part of the computation, so what? We don't care about the phase.
Yeah, phase error, sure, but not about, half a phase error.
Half phase error. So square root, well, okay.
Like a square root of z error.
Square root of z is still a phase error. But sure, so it's some rotation, some arbitrary rotation.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that doesn't matter, right? So the state will be a superposition of classical bit strings. But we don't ever interact those superpositions. We don't interfere them. So it's the same, it's just, this is not quite true. The errors might cause something to interfere later. But we'll get to that when we talk about the current errors. But the point is that it's basically the same. It's more a mixture, a probabilistic mixture of classical bit strings. So that's OK, too. But hey, if you're really worried, you could introduce extra phase errors on this part. Right? That really will decode errors. So need to make fault tolerant. Classical fault tolerance is enough. And luckily, classical fault tolerance, for classical computation, you have the repetition code. And you have then transversal gates. Can do everything. So I gave you this problem on the last problem set. There is a catch, because the error correction circuit is maybe a little complicated. Maybe somebody came up with a really clever one that's not complicated. But it can be done, and it doesn't need any kind of extra levels of recursion. Yeah?
So Daniel, I guess classical fault tolerance assumes that when there is a wrong behavior of a certain gate, it only remains in the domain of classically wrong, right? And it still remains interpretation gate and so on.
No. So again, well, yes and no. Okay. So this is what we were just discussing, right? So if you have some rotation that takes into a superposition, so what? I mean, we're not interacting different branches of the superposition. If you like, you could imagine introducing extra phase errors, which it doesn't have to be permutation, it's a mixture of permutations, right? That's the most general classical error. But that's kind of all that affects the circuit.
I mean, classical fault tolerance takes care of only that.
Well, that's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
But the point is that phase errors are not going to affect, if there were phase errors that are not corrected, that's not going to affect anything important, because you were using classical circuits before anyway. So the point is, the errors that aren't corrected are just meaningless in this case, the phase errors.
So we need fault tolerance only when it's bit errors.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe another way of saying this is that if you just think about how this is constructed, only bits, these are oscillas, right? These extra classical circuits. And so only bit flip errors in that part of the ancilla can ever propagate into the data. Because the things we do are controlled by these, and so phase errors will commute. It's another way to think about it. Yeah?
Is it simple to sketch what the teleportation circuit turns into, or was it like... If it's hard, don't worry about it.
It's not too hard. So the teleportation circuit, so imagine we have 7 qubits here or something. And so I want to draw multiple lines because it's going to be relevant somehow. So we do a Bell measurement here, and I won't draw that. And we get out of it things that used to be classical bits. So there used to be two classical bits that came out. And so now we have to repeat those. And then what we can do is something like this. So this would be a regular teleportation circuit. It would look something like this, where we're doing control knots, say control z's from the other ones. But if we're doing a pi over 8 gate, and so this is not an EPR pair, but some other ancilla, right? So now what we're doing here are controlled Clifford group gates. Okay? But that's okay, because now these are gates on physical qubits. They're not logical controlled Clifford group gates that we have to do. So the point is that this transversal thing, so this is like what we did with the CAT state when we wanted to measure a poly. So this is a repetition code. So these are either all 0 or all 1 in the absence of errors. Right? So when they're all 0, this doesn't do anything. And when they're all 1, we do the transversal Clifford group gate implementation. Okay? Yeah?
Do you not still need the projector for the bell measurement, which is a
measurement? Well, it's not a projector anymore. Now it's converting basically from this code to this code, this repetition code.
It's just looking at changing bases.
So the point is, this is an extension. I mean, so normally you'd say, well, what about, suppose we have no errors. Do we need measurements in the middle of a quantum computation? The answer is you can always delay it till the end. Right? You can replicate a measurement by doing a control knot to an ancilla bit. So we'd like to do the same thing here, but now we have to worry about errors. So we have to do something more complicated that takes the code word from 7-qubit code and converts it into a repetition code. Anything else? So maybe it's worth saying that there's another strategy. So it depends on exactly there's a couple of things worth saying. So first of all, there's a couple of things that can go wrong here, right? So this is the kind of worst case where you don't have any of this available. It might be that you have classical computation, but it's not any faster really than quantum computation. That's not so bad. That just means you have to wait around a little while you do the classical computation. And in that case, you know, you have to add extra weight steps for however long it takes. Okay, so that's not so serious. Similarly, measurements, in a lot of systems, measurements take much longer than a gate. And so maybe you don't want to wait around that long. So there's another approach there, which says basically, well, most of the time, you don't actually have to wait. I mean, I've been talking about we do error correction and we immediately correct the error. But if it's a poly error and you're only doing Clifford group gates, that's not so important, right? Because you can keep track of how the poly error will change under Clifford group gates. We can do that efficiently. I'll show you how to do that. And then you just wait for, so the measurement takes a long time, so you wait for it to catch up when necessary. And when necessary is when you do one of these non-transversal gates, non-Clifford group gates. So you have to do some little hand waving to see how you can manage that. Because if you have to wait too long, then it'll decohere. But you can still do error correction while that's happening. So there's a couple of steps involved there, but you can deal with that. So the other thing worth mentioning, of course, is that if you have to add this extra circuitry, well, again, it's going to hurt the threshold, right, because there's more overhead. Luckily, the threshold for classical computation is not so bad. So, well, hopefully it doesn't hurt the threshold too much. So the only people I think that have really studied this also did it in one dimension, where the threshold is so lousy anyway, for quantum computation, that this extra classical overhead was not really affecting things. But I don't think people have really studied it for the cases where you get much higher thresholds, say, with long-range gates. So there it might start to have some noticeable influence. Questions about this? Okay. So our sixth assumption.
So.
Yeah.
Before you start number six, I would like to come back a little bit on number two.
Number two, okay.
Yeah, it's just a very quick question. So when you say, the threshold is this from a proof or from a simulation?
Yeah.
So I kind of assume that when they do the proof, they sort of assume worst case scenario all the time. Mm-hmm. Right? When they do the simulation, do you assume worst case scenario and do a simulation, or is it more like, oh, when I do this gate, actually physically, that one is better than this other one, and you take everything into account?
So different simulations do different things. If you're going to do your simulation right, you should assume that the logical circuit you're doing is kind of a worst case circuit. So the main difference between proofs and simulations, well, okay, there's a lot of differences, but the main difference in assumptions is usually in the error model. So remember, for proof, we assumed an adversarial error model. And simulations frequently assume, say, a depolarizing channel. And it's not really clear how much that matters. I mean, it's certainly better to have a depolarizing channel in the sense that the error rate, I mean, this is the worst case, right? The error rate can only get better. It does seem to help a little bit. But it's not quite clear how much.
So basically those thresholds, it seems to be sort of some sort of lower bound on the value.
Well, so the point of having a proof is that it really does provide a lower bound, given the assumptions are satisfied.
I know, it doesn't mean that, like for example, a 7-qubit kill, it doesn't mean that if I have an error rate of 1 to the minus 4, that doesn't necessarily mean that I will never be able to do arbitrary long computation.
Oh, absolutely not. So, this is something to bear in mind about all of these threshold calculations, that they can never provide anything better than a lower bound, because there might be some new code that no one's thought of, or some new fault tolerance trick no one's thought of, that will raise the numbers. So that's always true. When you're talking about the proofs, there's lots of other things that you're assuming, right? You're making various conservative assumptions. Some of them we talked about before, like, well, so we assume that any two locations could cause this rectangle to be bad, but really we don't care about that. And then there's some extra overcounting because these rectangles are overlapping. So, if you have a pair of locations and they overlap, even if they do cause a problem, you're counting them twice because you're counting them in both rectangles, right? And all sorts of things like that. I mean, there's maybe bigger collections of errors that locally look like they're a problem, but globally you can see they're not. What else? Anyway, there's probably some other assumptions that we needed to make the proof, but are not actually true in a real system. So there's a lot of things in the proofs that could be loosened in principle to get a better value of the threshold. For simulations, I said, well, you should be looking at a worst-case circuit. But of course, in the real world, you won't necessarily have a worst-case circuit. And so it could be that there's some error rate which you can do some computations, and maybe very interesting computations, but not universal computations. It's another possibility. So we don't know really what happens. There is some true threshold below which you can do universal computations. But when you're just above that threshold, we don't really know what happens. And so there is some work actually on upper bounds of the threshold, but they're really, really lousy. And I wasn't going to go into that. I assume they're lousy. We don't know, right? It could be that. Let's put it this way. They're really far from anything that anyone's been able to get a lower bound. Yeah?
How lousy are they? What sort of numbers are coming?
Well, so I think, I mean, they're... Well, so here's one bound which is not a bound. I'll explain why. So presumably, you won't be able to do fault tolerance if you can't do error correction. We haven't really talked about the appropriate model of error correction here. But basically, if you look at the singleton path, there's some kind of version of that applies to this thing where errors are occurring probabilistically. And that says you can't do error correction with an error rate over 1/4 per time step. OK. So that seems like it should be an upper bound. The reason I say it's not necessarily a bound is because, again, this issue of, well, yeah, OK, so it's a slightly different issue. But it might be possible that you can do some kind of noisy fault-tolerant computation that doesn't allow you to actually store a qubit, but still allow you to, you know, do Shor's algorithm or kind of anything else that you could do in quantum polynomial real time. Maybe not quantum simulation per se, because that's kind of taking a quantum input and a quantum output. But anything with a classical input and a classical output, you might be able to do. That doesn't seem very likely. There's some other bounds which are kind of on the same order of magnitude, but I forget whether they're slightly larger or slightly smaller.
We're not going to force all orders of magnitude away from where these numbers are. So.
Yes, but right. So I guess you weren't here at the end of last lecture. But it turns out there's some techniques that use lots and lots of extra ancillas and create these really big ancilla factories, where simulations suggest the threshold could be above 1%, maybe as high as 5%. So it's still an order of magnitude almost, but half an order of magnitude at least.
Might be close. Bounds would say that if the circuit is noisy enough, then you can simulate them classically.
Right? Well, that's right. Yeah, so those are the other bounds of that. So that, those are actual bounds. But I don't remember exactly what numbers they've come up with. So that's why I didn't want to cite them. OK? So let's finish off the circuit assumptions. The last two are pretty quick, and then we'll take a break. So number six was that all locations take the same amount of time. And this is clearly not necessary, as we discussed before. And I think I had something else to say about it. Yeah, OK. It's the same things I said last time, right, which is, it's not very realistic, but a lot of models, for instance, 1-qubit gates are fast, 2-qubit gates are slow, although there's some where it might be the other way around. But of course, you can say, well, different locations take different amounts of time, and then you have to adjust your storage errors appropriately. But you have to remember that you have to keep everything synchronized, right? That if you do a whole bunch of 1-qubit gates over here, and this qubit up here is doing a 2-qubit gate, well, then eventually maybe they have to interact with each other. And so this one might have to wait around a long time while this one is doing this 2-qubit gate. One possible way to deal with that is just to absorb the 1-qubit gates into 2-qubit gates. Right? If it's taking such a short time, that's not really going to add very much time. So that's one possible solution. Anyway, there's not too much interesting, I think, to say about this. OK, so let's do the last one. Parallelism. So far, we've been assuming maximal parallelism, right? And in fact, the circuits that we drew had very few wait steps, which means that we're doing a pretty good job of taking advantage of this parallelism. But do we really need it? So what happens if we instead have a sequential circuit, completely sequential for error correction? Are we still going to be able to make that fault tolerant? Modulo the rest of the assumptions.
As long as your identities are faultless.
Right. So if we don't have any storage errors, that's OK, right? If we don't have any storage errors, we don't care about when we do anything. But if we do have storage errors, then there's a problem if we don't have any kind of parallelism, right? Because well, we have a whole bunch of qubits. We have n qubits. And, well, OK, so the one over here, we start to do error correction on. And we do error correction, and they're OK. And then we move over here and do some more error correction. And over here, some error correction, some error correction. But as we do this, these ones that we've already done, error correction, they're having errors again, right? And the bigger these computers, the longer they have to wait before we get back to them. And so the error rate will go above the threshold. The storage error rate will go above the threshold, and then we won't be able to correct them. Okay? So we certainly need some parallelism. But we don't certainly need complete parallelism. Right? So clearly, if we can do, say, one gate every two steps, well, sorry, do gates on half the qubits, then we can just kind of alternate, even and odd, and do one gate in every qubit every other step. Right? In that case, well, there's extra storage errors. Everything has to wait around an extra time step between gates. But so long as the error rates are low enough, we can still do that. Right? So in general, so if we can perform gates on a fraction f of qubits, then we're effectively taking each time step in the computation and making it 1 over f, I guess ceiling of 1 over f time steps. And so our effective storage error rates will increase appropriately. OK? That makes sense? Any questions, comments? Yes?
Daniel, I think I'm not kidding. So we were already counting identities, and we said that after counting identities, the total size of the circuit was poly.
Mm-hmm.
And now, so identity was just that, you know, if I performed one gate, the rest were untouched.
Yeah.
Right? So then by doing a sequential computation of the circuit itself, I'm just taking poly steps.
Yeah, but again, look, if you have t steps, or and you have an error rate p per step, right? Then the probability of having no error is, well what is it? It's 1 minus p to the t, right? Which is exponential in t. Some constant. Right? So if your qubit has to wait around for a time t, then the probability of it still being correct at the end of that time is incredibly small. Exponentially small. Even when t is quite modest. Polynomial, say, linear.
Isn't it 1 minus 1 minus p? 1 minus p to the t.
Sorry, you're right. So this is the probability of error that I wrote, so it's...
Okay.
Yeah?
Can you get away with, like, being able to operate on a square root fraction of qubits?
Well, let's think about that. Well, this argument still holds, right? If you can only perform gates on a fraction f of the qubits, then each one has to wait around time 1 over f, basically, between gates. I mean, you could distribute that unevenly. Some qubits would be OK, but then other qubits would have to wait longer. So the worst case is that the worst case qubit has to wait at least this long. And so if f is 1 over square root of n, then this becomes a time square root of n. And so it's increasing with the size of the computation. And eventually, it'll get too large, and there'll be some qubits that you just won't be able to correct. So in general, this has to be a constant fraction, you can see from this argument, that it can't increase with the size of the computation, if you want to still have a constant fraction. OK, why don't we take a break? And maybe I can convince Rahul in the break.